Mad Music by Anthony Pelcher, Part 2. The fact that Jenks and Lennon were not strong for each other, except to recognize each other's ability as engineers, was due to an incident of the past. This incident had caused a ripple of mirth in engineering circles when it happened, and the laugh was on the older man, Lennon. It was when radio was new. Lennon, a structural engineer, had paid little attention to radio. Jenks was the kind of engineer who dabbled in all sciences. He knew his radio. When Jenks first came to work with a technical sheepskin and a few tons of brass, Lennon accorded him only passing notice. Jenks craved the plaudits of the older man and his palship. Lennon treated him as a son, but did not warm to his social advances. "I'm as good an engineer as he is," mused Jenks. "And if he is going to high-hat me, I'll just put a swift one over on him and compel his notice." The next day, Jenks approached Lennon in conference and said, "I've got a curious bet on, Mr. Lennon. I am betting sound can travel a mile quicker than it travels a quarter of a mile." "What?" said Lennon. "I'm betting 50 that sound can travel a mile quicker than it can travel a quarter of a mile." "Oh, no, it can't," insisted Lennon. "Oh, yes, it can," decided Jenks. "I'll take some of that fool money myself," said Lennon. "How much?" asked Jenks. "As much as you want." "All right, $500. "How are you going to prove your contention?" "By stopwatches, and your men can hold the watches. We'll bet that a pistol shot can be heard 2 miles away quicker than it can be heard a quarter of a mile away." "Sound travels about a fifth of a mile a second. The rate varies slightly according to temperature," explained Lennon. "At the freezing point, the rate is 1,090 feet per second, and increases a little over 1 foot for every degree Fahrenheit." "Hot or cold," breezed Jenks, "I am betting you $500 that sound can travel 2 miles quicker than a quarter mile." "You're on, you damned idiot," shouted the completely exasperated Lennon. Jenks let Lennon's friends hold the watches, and his friend held the money. Jenks was to fire the shot. Jenks fired the shot in front of a microphone on a football field. One of Lennon's friends picked the sound up instantaneously on a 3-tube radio set 2 miles away. The other watch holder was standing in the open a quarter of a mile away, and his watch showed a second and a fraction. All hands agreed that Jenks had won the bet fairly. Lennon never exactly liked Jenks after that. Then Jenks rather aggravated matters by a habit. Whenever Lennon would make a very positive statement, Jenks would look owl-eyed and say, "Mr. Lennon, I'll have to sound you out about that." The heavy accent on the word "sound" nettled Lennon somewhat. Lennon never completely forgave Jenks for putting over this fast one. Socially, they were always more or less at loggerheads, but neither let this feeling interfere with their work. They worked together faithfully enough, and each recognized the ability of the other. And so it was that Lennon and Jenks, their heads together, worked all night in an attempt to find some cause that would tie responsibility for the disaster on Mother Nature. They failed to find it, and sleepy-eyed, they were forced to admit failure so far. The newspapers, to whom Mueller had said that he would not shirk any responsibility, began a hue and cry for the arrest of all parties in any way concerned with the direction of the building of the Colossus. When the death list from the crash and subway wreck reached 97, the press waxed nasty and demanded the arrest of Mueller, Linen, and Jenks in no uncertain tones. Half dead from lack of sleep, the three men were taken by the police to the district attorney's offices, and after a strenuous grilling, were formally placed under arrest on charges of criminal negligence. They put up a $50,000 bond in each case and were permitted to go and seek further to find the cause of what the newspapers now began calling the colossal failure. Several days were spent by Linen and Jenks in examining the wreckage which was being removed from Times Square, truckload after truckload, to a point outside the city. Here it was again sorted and examined and piled for future disposal. So far as could be found, every brick, every stone and ounce of material used in the building was perfect. Attorneys, however, assured Linen, Jenks, and Mueller that they would have to find the real cause of the disaster if they were to escape possible long prison sentences. Night after night, Jenks courted sleep, but it would not come. He began to grow wan and haggard. Jenks took to walking the streets at night, mile after mile, thinking, always thinking, and searching his mind for a solution of the mystery. It was evening. He had walked past the scene of the Colossus crash several times. He found himself on a side street. He looked up and saw in electric lights, Town Hall. Munsterbergen the Mad Musician. Concert here tonight. He took $5 from his pocket and bought a ticket. He entered with the crowd and was ushered to a seat. He looked neither to the right nor left. His eyes were sunken, his face lined with worry. Something within Jenks caused him to turn slightly. He was curiously aware of a beautiful girl who sat beside him. She had a mass of golden hair which seemed to defy control. It was wild, positively tempestuous. Her eyes were deep blue, and her skin as white as fleecy clouds in spring. He was dimly conscious that those glorious eyes were troubled. She glanced at him. She was aware that he was suffering. A great surge of sympathy welled in her heart. She could not explain the feeling. A great red plush curtain parted in the center and drew in graceful folds to the edges of the proscenium. A small stage was revealed. A tousle-headed man with glaring, beady black eyes, dressed in black evening clothes, stepped forward and bowed. Under his arm was a violin. He brought the violin forward. His nose, like the beak of some great bird, bobbed up and down in acknowledgment of the plaudits which greeted him. His long, nervous fingers began to caress the instrument, and his lips began to move. Jenks was aware that he was saying something, but was not at all interested. What he said was this: Maybe, yes, I couldn't talk so good English, but you could understood it, yes? And now I tell you that I never play the compositions of any man. I extemporize exclusively. I just play and play, and maybe you should listen, yes? If I please you, I am just happy. Jenks' attention was drawn to him. He noted his wild appearance. He sure looks mad enough, mused Jenks. The violinist flipped the fiddle up under his chin. He drew the bow over the strings and began a gentle melody that reminded one of raindrops falling on calm waters. Jenks forgot his troubles. He forgot everything. He slumped in his seat and his eyes closed. The rain continued falling from the strings of the violin. Suddenly, the melody changed to a glad little lilting measure as sweet as love itself. The sun was coming out again, and the birds began to sing. There was the trill of a canary with the sun on its cage. There was the song of the thrush, the mockingbird, and the meadowlark. These blended finally into a melodious burst of chirping melody, which seemed a chorus of the wild birds of the forest and glen. Then the lilting love measure again. It tore at the heartstrings and brought tears to one's eyes. Unconsciously, the girl next to Jenks leaned toward him. Involuntarily, he leaned to meet her. Their shoulders touched. The cloud of her golden hair came to rest against his dark locks. Their hands found each other with gentle pressure. Both were lost to the world. Abruptly, the music changed. There was a succession of broken treble notes that sounded like the crackling of flames. Moans, deep and melancholy, followed. These grew more strident and prolonged, giving place to abject howls, suggesting the lamentations of the damned. The hands of the boy and girl gripped tensely. They could not help shuddering. The violin began to produce notes of a leering, jeering character, growing more horrible with each measure until they burst in a loud guffaw of maniacal laughter. The whole performance was as if someone had taken a heaven and plunged it into a hell. The musician bowed jerkily and was gone. There was no applause, only wild exclamations. Half the house was on its feet, the other half sat as if glued to chairs. The boy and the girl were standing, their hands still gripping tensely. "Come, let's get out of here," said Jenks. The girl took her wrap, and Jenks helped her into it. Hand in hand, they fled the place. In the lobby, their eyes met. And for the first time, they realized they were strangers. Yet deep in their hearts was a feeling that their fates had been sealed. "My goodness!" burst from the girl. "It can't be helped now," said Jenks decisively. "What can't be helped?" asked the girl, although she knew in her heart. "Nothing can be helped," said Jenks. Then he added, "We should know each other by this time. We have been holding hands for an hour." The girl's eyes flared. "You have no right to presume on that situation," she said. Jenks could have kicked himself. "Forgive me," he said. "It was only that I just wanted so to know you. Won't you let me see you home?" "You may," said the girl simply, and she led the way to her own car. They drove north. Their bodies seemed like magnets. They were again shoulder to shoulder, holding hands. "Will you tell me your name?" pleaded Jenks. "Surely," replied the girl. "I am Elaine Linen." "What?" exploded Jenks. "Why, I work with a Linen, an engineer with the Mueller Construction Company." "He is my father," she said. "Why, we are great friends," said the boy. "I am Jenks, his assistant. At least, we work together." "Yes, I have heard of you," said the girl. "It is strange the way we met. My father admires your work, but I am afraid you are not great friends." The girl had forgotten her troubles. She chuckled. She had heard about the way Jenks had sounded her father out. Jenks was speechless. The girl continued, "I don't know whether to like you or hate you. My father is an old dear. You were cruel to him." Jenks was abject. I did not mean to be," he said. "He rather belittled me without realizing it. I had to make my stand. The difference in our years made him take me rather too lightly. I had to compel his notice if I was to advance." "Oh," said the girl. "I am sorry. So sorry." "You might not have been altogether at fault," said the girl. "Father forgets at times that I have grown up. I resent being treated like a child. But he is the soul of goodness and fatherly care." "I know that," said Jenks. Every engineer knows his mathematics. It was this fact, coupled with what the world calls a lucky break, that solved the Colossus mystery. Nobody can get around the fact that 2 and 2 make 4. Jenks had happened on accomplishment to advance in the engineering profession, and it was well for him that he had reached a crisis. He had never believed in luck or in hunches. So it was good for him to be brought face to face with the fact that sometimes the footsteps of man are guided. It made him begin to look into the engineering of the universe, to think more deeply, and to acknowledge a higher power. With Linen, he had butted into a stone wall. They were coming to know what real trouble meant. The fact that they were innocent did not make the steel bars of a cage any more attractive. Their troubles began to wrap about them with the clammy intimacy of a shroud. Then came the lucky break. Next to his troubles, Jenks' favorite topic was the mad musician. He tried to learn all he could about this uncanny character at whose concert he had met the girl of his life. He had learned 2 facts that made him perk up and think. 1 was that the mad musician had had offices and a studio in the Colossus, and was one of the first to move in. The other was that the mad musician took great delight in shattering glassware with notes of, or vibrations from, a violin. Nearly everyone knows that a glass tumbler can be shattered by the proper note sounded on a violin. The mad musician took delight in this trick. Jenks courted his acquaintance and saw him shatter a row of glasses of different sizes by sounding different notes on his fiddle. The glasses crashed one after another like gelatin balls hit by the bullets of an expert rifleman. Then Jenks, the engineer who knew his mathematics, put 2 and 2 together. It made 4, of course. "Listen, Linen," he said to his co-worker. "This fiddler is crazier than a flock of cuckoos. If he can crack crockery with violin sound vibrations, is it not possible, by carrying the vibrations to a much higher power, that he could crack a pile of stone, steel, brick, and cement? Like the Colossus?" "Possible, but hardly probable." "Still," Linen mused, "when you think about it and put 2 and 2 together. Let's go after him and see what he is doing now." Both jumped for their coats and hats. As they fared forth, Jenks cinched his argument. "If a madman takes delight in breaking glassware with a vibratory wave or vibration, how much more of a thrill would he get by crashing a mountain?" "Wild, but unanswerable," said Linen. Jenks had been calling on the mad musician at his country place. He had a studio in the Colossus, he reminded Lennon. He must have reopened somewhere else in town. I wonder where. Musicians are great union men, said Lennon. Phone the union. Teddy Jenks did, but the union gave the last known town address as the Colossus. He would remain in the same district around Times Square, reasoned Jenks. Let's page out the big buildings and see if he is not preparing to crash another one. Fair enough, said Lennon, who was too busy with the problem at hand to choose his words. Together the engineers started a canvas of the big buildings in the theatrical district. After four or five had been searched without result, they entered the 30-story Acme Theater building. Here they learned that the mad musician had leased a 4-room suite just a few days before. This suite was on the 15th floor, just halfway up in the big structure. They went to the manager of the building and frankly stated their suspicions. "We want to enter that suite when the tenant is not there," they explained, "and we want him forestalled from entering while we are examining the premises."
"Hadn't we better notify the police?" asked the building manager, who had broken out in a sweat when he heard the dire disaster which might be in store for the stately Acme building.
"Not yet," said Lennon. "You see, we are not sure. We have just been putting two and two together."
"Well, we'll get the building detective anyway," insisted the manager.
"Let him come along, but do not let him know until we are sure. If we are right, we will find a most unusual infernal machine," said Lennon. The three men entered the suite with a pass key. The detective was left outside in the hall to halt anyone who might disturb the searchers. It was as Jenks had thought. In an inner room, they found a diabolical machine, a single string stretched across two bridges, one of brass and one of wood. A big horsehair bow attached to a shaft operated by a motor was automatically sawing across the string. The note resulting was evidently higher than the range of the human ear, because no audible sound resulted. It was later estimated that the destructive note was several octaves higher than the highest note on a piano. The entire machine was enclosed in a heavy wire net cage, securely bolted to the floor. Neither the string nor bow could be reached. It was evidently the mad musician's idea that the devilish contrivance should not be reached by hands other than his own. How long the infernal machine had been operating, no one knew, but the visitors were startled when the building suddenly began to sway perceptibly. Jenks jumped forward to stop the machine, but could not find a switch.
"See if the machine plugs in anywhere in a wall socket," he shouted to Lennon, who promptly began examining the walls.
Jenks shouted to the building manager to phone the police to clear the streets around the big building.
"Tell the police that the Acme Theater building may crash at any moment," he instructed.
The engineers were perfectly cool in face of the great peril, but the building manager lost his head completely and began to run around in circles, muttering, "Oh my God, save me!" and other words of supplication that blended into an incoherent babble. Jenks rushed to the man, trying to still his wild hysteria. The building continued to sway dangerously. Jenks looked from a window. An enormous crowd was collecting, watching the big building swinging a foot out of plumb like a giant pendulum. The crowd was growing. Should the building fall, the loss of life would be appalling. It was mid-morning. The interior of the building teemed with thousands of workers, for all floors above the third were offices. Teddy Jenks turned suddenly. He heard the watchman in the hall scream in terror. Then he heard a body fall. He rushed to the door to see the mad musician standing over the prostrate form of the detective, a devilish grin on his distorted countenance. The madman turned, saw Jenks, and started to run. Jenks took after him. Up the staircase, the madman rushed toward the roof. Teddy followed him two floors and then rushed out to take the elevators. The building, in its mad swaying, had made it impossible for the lifts to be operated. Teddy realized this with a distraught gulp in his throat. He returned to the stairway and took up the pursuit of the madman. The corridors were beginning to fill with screaming men and wailing girls. It was a sight never to be forgotten. Laboriously, Jenks climbed story after story without getting sight of the madman. Finally, he reached the roof. It was waving like swells on a lake before a breeze. He caught sight of the mad musician standing on the street wall, 30 stories from the street, a leer on his devilish visage. He jumped for him. The madman grasped him and lifted him up to the top of the wall, as a cat might have lifted a mouse. Both men were breathing heavily as a result of their 15-story climb. The madman tried to throw Teddy Jenks to the street below. Teddy clung to him. The two battled desperately as the building swayed. The dense crowd in the street had caught sight of the two men fighting on the narrow coping, and the shout which rent the air reached the ears of Jenks. The mind of the engineer was still working clearly, but a wild fear gripped his heart. His strength seemed to be leaving him. The madman pushed him back, bending his spine with brute strength. Teddy was forced to the narrow ledge that had given the two men footing. The fingers of the madman gripped his throat. He was dimly conscious that the swaying of the building was slowing down. His reason told him that Lennon had found the wall socket and had stopped the sawing of the devil's bow on the engine of hell. He saw the madman draw a knife. With his last remaining strength, he reached out and grasped the wrist above the hand which held the weapon. In spite of all he could do, he saw the madman inching the knife nearer and nearer his throat. Grim death was peering into the bulging eyes of Teddy Jenks when his engineering knowledge came to his rescue. He remembered the top stories of the Acme building were constructed with a step of 10 feet in from the street line for every story of construction above the 24th floor. If we fall, he reasoned, we can only fall one story. Then he deliberately rolled his own body and the weight of the madman who held him over the edge of the coping. At the same time, he twisted the madman's wrist so the point of the knife pointed to the madman's body. There was a dim consciousness of a painful impact. Teddy had fallen underneath, but the force of the two bodies coming together had thrust the knife deep into the entrails of the mad musician. Clouds, which had been collecting in the sky, began a splattering downpour. The storm grew in fury, and lightning tore the heavens, while thunder boomed and crackled. The rain began falling in sheets. This served to revive the unconscious Teddy. He painfully withdrew his body from under that of the madman. The falling rain, stained with the blood of the mad musician, trickled over the edge of the building. Teddy dragged himself through a window and passed his hand over his forehead, which was aching miserably. He tried to get to his feet and fell back, only to try again. Several times he tried, and then, his strength returning, he was able to walk. He made his way to the studio where he had left Lennon, and found him there surrounded by police, reporters, and others. The infernal machine had been rendered harmless, but was kept intact as evidence. Catching sight of Teddy, Lennon shouted with joy. I stopped the damn thing, he chuckled like a pleased schoolboy. Then, observing Teddy's exhausted condition, he added,
Why, you look like you have been to a funeral.
I have, said Teddy. You'll find that crazy fiddler dead on the 29th story. Look out the window of the 30th story, he instructed the police, who had started to recover the body. He stabbed himself. He is either dead or dying. It proved that he was dead. No engineering firm is responsible for the actions of a madman, so the Mueller Construction Company was given a clean bill of health. Jenks and Elaine Linen were with the girl's father in his study. They were asking for the paternal blessing. Linen was pretending to be hard to convince.
Now, my daughter, he said, this young man takes $500 of my good money by sounding me out, as he calls it. Then he comes along and tries to take my daughter away from me. It is positively high-handed. It dates back to the football game.
Daddy, dear, don't be like that, said Elaine, who was on the arm of his chair with her own arms about him.
I tell you, Elaine, this dates back to the fall of 1927.
It dates back to the fall of Eve, said Elaine. When a girl finds her man, no power can keep him from her. If you won't give me to Teddy Jenks, I'll elope with him.
Well, all right then.
Kiss me, said Linen, as he turned toward his radio set.
One and one makes one, said Teddy Jenks.
Every engineer knows his mathematics.
End of Mad Music by Victor Pelcher.